You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Keith Phipps
and
Tosh Robinson.
Producer Genevieve Kosky is behind the boards this week, auto-tuning us. On the first half of this episode, we discuss The Exterminating Angel, Louis Buñuel's anarchic satire of societal elites trapped at an opulent dinner party. For the second half of the episode, we're staying inside for Mother, Darren Aronofsky's allegorical horror comedy What's It, which also takes place entirely on a single estate where many arrive and no one leaves. No one in Mother has a name, but it's safe to say that Jennifer Lawrence stars as the title character, a woman who's been working hard to restore an old home back to its original glory. Javier Bardem plays her much older husband, an author who is experiencing writer's block and is constantly searching for inspiration. In the meantime, Bardem invites a wayward stranger, played by Ed Harris, to stay overnight, and he's soon joined by his wife, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, and later their two adult sons. As the number of people who descend on this isolated estate start to swell, a number of bizarre and frightening incidents leave Lawrence feeling unnerved, particularly when she discovers she's pregnant. What happens next is increasingly inexplicable, so we'll stop there. We'll get into our reactions to Mother, as well as how it compares to The Exterminating Angel, after the break.
Oh, it scared me.
Please, come in. Hello.
Hello.
He's a stranger. We're just gonna let him sleep in our house.
Hello. Did you know he had a wife?
I want to thank you for your hospitality. He has pictures of you in his luggage.
What were you doing in their luggage?
You really love him. God help you. Quiet!
All right, so I'm really, really curious to hear your reaction. We're going to this pretty cold. I think you have a sense of where I'm at on this movie, but I have no idea where you, Tasha, or you, Keith, are on this polarizing and much-discussed film. So let's have it.
I got to say, this is a terrific film, asterisk. I think it's a terrific film. I think what it does is very interesting, and the central allegory is really compelling to think about. I think, as with some of other of Aronofsky's film, its cleverness and its ingeniousness is really foregrounded in a way that would be obnoxious if the filmmaking style, if everything wasn't on point in every every way. I mean, just the style of the film, the performances, the look, the pace, the rhythm. I mean, it is remarkably well done. I think a lesser filmmaker, I mean, as Tosh likes to say, it is tautology to say this, but in the hands of a lesser filmmaker, it wouldn't be as good of a film. but I think in the hands of a lesser filmmaker, as clever as the conception of this film is, I think it would be a disastrous film. Whereas I think it's an extremely compelling film I'm looking forward to revisiting and really looking forward to talking over with everyone.
Tasha?
That is pretty much exactly where I am. It's a great film. Asterisk is a terrific way to describe it. My experience in the theater watching this film was pretty much the split that's developed over whether it's a good or bad movie, whether it's overly obvious or a terrific piece of filmmaking, is the split that developed in my mind as I was watching it. Because part of me was sort of taking in the visceral experience of watching this film. I think it's incredibly shot, and I think particularly as things start to disintegrate in the back half of the film, there's just a degree to which the filmmaking becomes almost rapturous. It's amazing how well he keeps up that story. It reminded me of Children of Men and some of those long take shots where he just coordinates these incredible moments of chaos that last forever and like walk you through a nightmare. At the same time, I found myself thinking, the metaphor here is so obvious and so thudding and so clunky. And then I got out of it and I read Alyssa Wilkinson's piece over at Vox explaining what the clunky metaphor was that I hadn't seen. I had seen a different one. And then I talked to Angie Hahn from Mashable, who I met at a screening, and we talked about sort of the over-obviousness of it. And she said, I have had five different people tell me the metaphor in this thing is way too obvious. And I asked each one of them what the metaphor was and they told me five different answers.
Absolutely correct. That is the exact experience that I had. I went to see this film later than everybody at the festival. So it was actually the last film I saw at the festival. And my two roommates, Noel Murray and Mike D'Angelo, had seen it before me. And I got in to talk about the film with them. And they both had extremely well-supported takes on the allegory of the film that were opposed. Noel had it as what I think Alyssa and Aronofsky himself has it as a religious allegory. Mike had his allegory about art and the idea, the artistic idea. And so, and both of them had all of this evidence to back up their points and some counter evidence to diminish the other reading of the film. So it's fascinating to see like how you could both on the one hand say, oh, well it's just so obvious with the allegory. And then on the other side, not agree on what the allegory actually is. I mean, I would side more, I guess, upon reflection on the religious aspect of it. But I like it's that it can be read in different ways. And I just think it is remarkable filmmaking. And I will confess that I guess the part of the Aronofsky touch is that he annoys you. You know, I mean, it's kind of an annoying film. Like even, you know, even the really good ones, Requiem for a Dream, Pie. I mean, how annoying is Pie? But it's really great. You know, he just works at this style that is ugly and hyper-aggressive, and it wears you down, and it's not always pleasant to be in the theater watching it happen, but it works. And
it gets under your skin.
It does. And I got to say, you know, even as I say it's unpleasant, I kind of had a ball with this film, particularly the first half. I mean, the second half does go haywire.
Pfeiffer and Harris are so fun.
Yes.
They're
oh, my God.
Fun to watch. And,
that's
and it's like, I want to see them as a bickering married couple that also has lots of sex in other movies.
Oh, she's just, Pfeiffer in particular is so brilliant in this movie. She's so sinister. You know, it's so immediately, you know, she's being, you know, Jennifer Lawrence is doing everything she can to be as courteous, you know, and welcoming a host, even though she doesn't want any of these people in her house. And Pfeiffer answers that with just ice and lemonade, spiked lemonade. And I just miss
some
Michelle Pfeiffer's
fruit.
Just one of my favorite actresses, and I've just missed her for so long, and it's so great to have her back.
What are you saying? Pfeiffer comes into paradise and brings this fruit that she keeps offering that turns out to have negative ramifications.
Yeah, yeah.
So grand unifying theories, hit me.
It's the Bible played out from beginning to end, Old Testament and New, with a kind of embodiment of the other side of God. I think this is Alyssa's take, right? Bardem is sort of the public-facing, masculine God who gets all the credit. And Jennifer Lawrence as the unheralded other side of creation that without which no creation could happen at all.
Reading that essay, I resisted it for probably three paragraphs. And then somewhere along the line, I went, oh, they're Cain and Abel. That's why the sons show up out of nowhere.
That's when the film clicked to me. It's like I kind of thought I knew what it was up to, and then when the two sons they bicker, they fight. One ends with a mark on his head. I'm like, oh, I know what you're doing, Darren Aronofsky.
Oh, so did you catch it like while you were watching it?
Yeah.
You twigged into the
biblical
thing?
And I'm not gonna say I'm super clever because I did try to avoid as much as possible. I did edit our review by Mike Ryan, who avoided spoilers, but said something like, it's a film about how Aronofsky does not care for humanity, and that kind of helped me click into place, too. But yeah, it was the Cain and Abel thing that really did it for me.
You know, I didn't catch that reading in the theater at all because I was so caught up in the symbolism of Bardem basically being a celebrity, somebody who creates something, and then people come and progressively want more and more pieces of him. Mm-hmm. And throughout the entire film, Lawrence is trying to push back on that and is trying to create a private space where they can have a relationship and where they can create – first a relationship of their own and then a child of their own. But more and more, the outside world is coming in and picking everything apart. And by the midpoint of the movie, she's pregnant and then she has a child and everybody wants to seize on the child. She has created this house, like physically created it with her own hands, and people are breaking in and literally stealing pieces of it because they want pieces of it. And throughout all of that, all I could think of was the way the celebrity press seizes on pretty much from somebody's gone up a pant size, is she pregnant, to the endless coverage of flaunting the baby bump, which means going out in public while pregnant, to how many pictures of the baby can we steal, or can we contract for exclusive pictures of the baby. And then there's an endless series of judging how they're holding the baby, how the baby's dressing. Like, are they bringing the baby out in public? They're bad parents. Are they concealing the baby at home? They're bad parents. There's just so much judgment around. And I got caught up in all of the interpretations of celebrity life mm-hmm. and losing the right to privacy. I didn't see the biblical aspect of it at all.
It's so interesting. I mean, all that's there. I mean, I think all that is very much, you're correctly reading that, that is the texture of the film. But I mean, I think it's going to play as a very different film for you if you go watch it a second time.
I think it's also going to play as a very different film for people like Keith. We've discussed this before. Like, you and I both grew up in fairly religious households, mm-hmm. fairly Christian, fundamentalist religious households. So we both have like a pretty good grounding in the step-by-step aspects of the biblical story. To somebody who isn't steeped in that background, like, the metaphor's not going to play at all here. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Aronofsky also says it's about climate change and yeah. about people coming in and taking apart, literally taking apart the environment until everything falls apart, and making horrible decisions based on selfish reasons until the world literally disintegrates, as mm-hmm. it does in the movie.
So, well, you can read, I mean, the house, if you can want to see the house as Mother Earth or whatever.
Yeah, mm-hmm. one does not negate the other. You can definitely use the biblical allegory as a environmental metaphor.
Yeah, and double as a metaphor about celebrity and about the artistic
and
impulse.
Artist people. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So
yeah.
It can be all of these things. The question that I'm still stirring around in my head is whether that makes it a better metaphor or a worse one. If it can be all of these things simultaneously, I almost want to say that it's too broad, and yet at the same time, it is so very specific in the biblical particulars. It's so very specific in the fame particulars. Our buddy Glenn Weldon tweeted about how, you know, in his opinion, metaphor at this level just turns a movie into a puzzle. And once you've put the puzzle together, it's very uninteresting. That is just kind of like a one-for-one correspondence. And I can certainly see that reading, too. But I can't get away from the fact that the movie moved me emotionally.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves in bringing in Exterminating Angel, but I think part of what makes it so effective is it is grounded in real emotions and people that play like real characters. And if they were just one-for-one stand-ins for I'm a symbol for this, it would not work. But I mean, these, you know, Jennifer Lawrence is, I mean, maybe she can be inexpressive. I've never seen her movie and not be moved by her, just because she is such an expressive actress, and just her presence and what she does, even when she's not really explicitly doing anything in the frame, is usually quite affecting.
Yeah, even when she plays roles that are pointedly inexpressive, like Katniss in The Hunger Games, the way in which she is inexpressive is emotionally moving in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, to kind of go back to what Glenn said, I reject that idea just so totally, because I think that it is a challenge for a puzzle picture to have an emotional core to it. But I almost feel like the really great ones, the Mementos, the Exoticas of the world, you know, and Mother I would include in this as well, when those pieces come together, they reveal something more and you're moved by what the picture looks like. You know, I think the implication is that puzzle movies are too worked out or too schematic and have no mystery to them. But I really see that as Mother. The elasticity of this film as an allegory is, to me, an unmitigated strength. Hmm. And it makes it just a fascinating to watch, fascinating to talk about, to unpack, to try to take pieces of the film that might support your reading of it and hold those up against pieces of the film that might support another reading. I mean, this is just a fun film to talk about. I mean, as much hell as it's caused, you know, audiences around the United States who gave it an F cinema score, it is, I think it's a lot of fun to unpack.
It's that really fun movie in which a baby is eaten.
Well, yes.
But it's, you know, it's not that
that bad.
I mean, I am glad that I didn't see the biblical allegory while I was in the theater, that I was too focused on the other allegory. Mm-hmm. Because while I knew that nothing good was going to happen to that baby, if I'd seen early on where it was going at the point where she got pregnant, I would have kind of rolled my eyes because I would have known what those story beats were going to be exactly. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad I didn't see the way it was going to play out until I got there. And I think that that is a problem with the puzzle movie, is if you twigged the puzzle pieces too early, you know, it might lay itself out for you in a way that sabotages the story itself.
Maybe. But boy, I think the film is just so full of twists and turns and things you just never expect. It kind of like it tapers off a little bit in the second act, which is in the first and second act, it's crazy enough, and then it finds this other gear entirely for the last third. I think it's kind of a good time at the movies.
Well, the people who gave it a cinema score of F disagree with
they
you.
They really do. But I mean, this is one of those movies that are, you know, I wrote an article about this, about the movies that
I was just
got,
about to say.
Movies
if,
that
if only somebody
proposing
a
festival of films that get F cinema scores, films like Solaris by Soderbergh, or The Box, or
I like The Box,
or Bug, or you know, and I think it just has to do with
you lost me at The Bug.
Extreme. There's a lot of extreme aspects of the film. These films are tough to take, but mostly they just don't behave. This does not behave like any movie you know you might expect as someone who goes to the multiplex on a regular basis.
And I don't want to get too sidetracked with the whole cinema score thing, but they're also all these films have in common is they are impossible to market, and they are also deceptively marketed.
Yeah.
This was sold as a creepy horror film, mm-hmm. about Jennifer Lawrence being alone in a house and people show up.
Yeah, Home Invaders. It was sold as a Home Invader horror film.
It is that.
It's very there.
But
a
it
home
is also it also has connections to The Exterminating Angel, so maybe we should get to those. We'll be back to talk about the connections between Mother and The Exterminating Angel.
Lemonade.
Oops. Oh, careful.
Thought you might like some.
Yes, thank you.
Secret family recipe.
Which part? The lemons? How's your hand?
Oh. Still stinging.
I'm sorry.
It's not like it was your fault. You don't have any painkillers, do you? Are you telling me the truth?
I really don't have any. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Now it's time for connections when we bring these two films together, talk about all the things they have in common. And I'm just excited that they have so much in common because this was not the film I was expecting at all. You know, we have to, you know, when we prepare for episodes of the Next Picture Show, we like have to speculate based on the information that we know from the synopsis, from past work, from trailers, what these films might suggest, so we can kind of get ready for them and bat some titles around. The Exterminating Angel was not a title that we brought up, and yet there's a really strong connection between the two, particularly in the premise in the first half of Mother.
And that came up because, like, Keith, weren't you the one that said Aronofsky had specifically cited it as one of his references?
I was about to say that I just read that in an interview, so I don't think it was
somebody.
Me.
Somebody yeah. Made that point.
I think Scott made.
Someone
made
did. I was in that discussion that I had with Mike and Noel after seeing the movie. Mm-hmm. I asked for their opinion, and they said, no, you don't want to do Polanski. You should do Buñuel, or you should do something like Godard's Weekend.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, he has been doing a series of interviews, and this film has come up as a direct inspiration. But I'm trying to think, we'd be really struggling if we had done Repulsion or Rosemary's Baby as much as I like those films.
I mean, I think we'd be struggling to find the kind of one-on-one correspondences that we're about to talk about. But to me, Repulsion still has a really strong emotional connection,
sure,
to Mother, the way it plays out.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that just descent into madness, that constant assault, mm-hmm, that she feels, the single setting. I mean, there are definitely some connections to that film. And I think you could also make connections to Rosemary's Baby in the sense that there is this conspiracy afoot that she's not a part of, that she's not in control of what her husband is doing and what the guests are doing and what the hordes of people who eventually descend on the house is doing. And they're all coming together for some purpose that she has no influence or control over, and she doesn't know what it's for. So the Polanski influence is not completely absent, but you know, it's just such a neat one-to-one between Mother and The Exterminating Angel, which both have I guess the first connection would be allegory. They both kind of have a big sweeping allegory in common.
I think one is more sweeping than the other, though. I think we're getting sort of the whole of history with Mother and possibly to prehistory and post-history in some ways. It's got a really interesting ending where the last shot is of another mother. Like here we go. Here's a connection. Like Exterminating Angel, it has a truly baffling ending.
Well, like Exterminating Angel, it has a cyclical ending. True. I mean, the end of Mother kind of implies that the house once again burns down, which is where the movie sort of starts, is the idea that the house has burned down and then has been rebuilt. And it's kind of the big bang, big crunch cycle, the idea that the universe itself is cyclical. And then with Exterminating Angel, we kind of get, and it's all begun again. So I think in both cases, you kind of have a closed loop that's meant to represent kind of the way the world turns.
And I think both advance a fairly cynical view of civilization
and
what happens when people get together in a certain situation and order breaks down and humans behave deplorably, whether it's how they treat each other in The Exterminating Angel when they're trapped in this space. And
who gets to use the bathroom first?
Right, exactly. They're tackling each other and are reduced to this sort of savage behavior. Or in Mother, where you have these characters who are taking so much from her, especially, but just from the house and from the baby eventually. They're just taking this beautiful thing that has been created and they're stripping it down to the rot underneath. You know, they're destroying the earth, I guess, if you want to consider it as an environmental metaphor as well.
I think in both cases, there's a pretty strong feeling that like one person alone is dignified and civilized and quiet, and two people together can build a really important and deep connection. And then by the time you add the third person, it's already too many people. The more people there are, and this could also be considered an environmental message in terms of overpopulation. Mm-hmm. But it could also just be a condemnation of like society as a whole. There's kind of a sense that the more people are added to the scenario, the more chaotic things get, the more things get out of hand, the more people's worst impulses are pushed further and further. And the more, if one person acts on an impulse, a destructive impulse or a greedy impulse, it just primes everybody else to panic and act on their worst impulses.
Yeah, like this permission structure that suddenly pops in, you know, when people are, you know, sitting on the on the unfinished sink or something like that, or and I guess it really starts with, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer's character repeatedly going to this room that Jennifer Lawrence is telling her not to go into, and it just, you know, as more people go into the house, you know, they treat it haphazardly. They have no standards, they have no rules, and that's what ends up happening.
You're saying the moment where they don't heed the word of the people who own the house, and there's a tremendous flood. Is that what you're referring to?
There is a flood in the film.
Yes, there is. Well, strangely, yeah. and you know what? When the house floods, suddenly everybody leaves it, and we're back to our two people, like our family unit, mm-hmm. again. Until people start creeping back in, there doesn't seem to be a moment where many animals flock into the house, which I think is a real flaw in the movie.
Yeah.
I think Aronofsky needs to recut it.
Animals are expensive.
He discovered that with Noah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I guess he'd already done his detailed
Noah. He did two Noah movies in a row. Noah scene, at least, in this
one. And I kind of like that Russell Crowe in that movie and Javier Bardem in this movie are playing characters who, you know, represent in your Sunday school class, you know, pure decency, right? But then have this side of just anger and wrath.
And Noah's complicated even in the Bible. I mean,
you think
he's drunk, his children see as shame, and not all good for Noah. But yeah.
Yeah, see, I only got the Sunday school version.
Yeah. Yeah, keep reading.
So this seems like a good time to talk about another connection, which is religion, which is obviously a huge part of Mother. And then maybe an incidental or a sliver of The Exterminating Angel, but not an insignificant one.
I think you could go see either of these films as a practicing Christian and not be offended. That's my controversial statement. I think you can see The Exterminating Angel as a critique of religious hypocrisy, and you can see this as a really powerful metaphor for the Christian faith and how it gets perverted and misused and misunderstood, and maybe sort of a pessimistic or fatalistic take on humanity itself, where it's sort of doomed to always fall short and to destroy, but still see them as films that aren't necessarily attacking the faith itself.
I think you have more faith in the modern American Christian in particular than I do. Because I mean, my experience with any sort of organized Christianity in cinema is that, like, the violence alone would outweigh the any sort of, like, intelligent nuance that's going on in these stories. Like, I just, I see Christians that I've had contact with both in my personal life and online more recently. Just, I think they would be so offended by the idea, if nothing else, the fact that there is no religion in mother that comes out of the child, out of the Christ child. There's only false religion. There's only ever bad messages. But more importantly, it's a gory movie.
No, I don't know about that. The second book that the poet writes, some sort of like New Testament of some kind, is very well received. It's just sort of grabbed and claimed by different parties. Sometimes I think where you would get into sacrilege is the whole idea of mother to begin with, emphasizing this
that is true
non-patriarchal aspect of creation. But I don't know. I think it's an interesting challenge if you're a person of faith.
Yeah, I mean, it does. Like, God in this movie comes across as a pretty dopey and clueless character. I think,
and at times malevolent, at times just kind of thoughtless, mm-hmm. too. You know, maybe never intentionally malevolent, but certainly so neglectful as to be unintentionally malevolent. It's a really fascinating.
Vain as well.
Yeah, it's really fascinating certainly. Characterization. I mean, I don't know who else could play this other than Javier Bardem, but you kind of need that sort of big presence, like, you know, handsome, but also almost kind of a caricature of masculinity in some ways. Mm-hmm. It's perfect casting.
He has an incredible way of being comforting and sinister at the same time, of being warm and malicious at the same time, of convincing you that he really cares about her, and at the same time he only cares about himself. It's a pretty remarkable. I think all of the performances in this movie of any significance are really remarkable.
And I really have to give a shout out to the rather against type casting of Kristen Wiig.
She's great
in this film.
And the very on-type casting of Stephen McCaddy, one of my favorite Canadian character actors as the Zealot.
This is maybe a point where the roads start to separate. The tone and the style of these two films are pretty much at opposite ends of each other, right?
No, it's really true.
Because Aronofsky's got it going to 11, or maybe he has it going to 10 in the first two-thirds, and then he goes to 11. But there's an intensity and relentlessness of style and camera movement and these sort of spring-loaded effects that is not at all similar to Buñuel's approach. But I do actually think you have one little thing in common, I do think that the films are both kind of funny. I mean, I think you're not agreeing with me on Mother being funny, but I think there's Jennifer Lawrence's exasperation in the first half with all of this absurd situation that's happening that she has no control over. I think that's really funny.
And her instinct to be polite is challenged beyond the breaking point of anyone else, yet she never quite gets there.
Identify with that so much. So in that sense, maybe they do overlap just a tiny bit of having kind of a deadpan, you know, laugh but not out loud type of quality. But in other ways, they're not really similar at all.
I don't see it at all. I mean, her manifest desperation, almost from moment one, I found very, very affecting, and it activated my anxiety. Uh-huh. It made me just feel very worried for her. And I think one of the interesting things about Mother is the way it plays with sympathy around her, because, you know, when they first show up and she's very defensive about it, you can kind of see Bardem's point. Like, you know, it's his home. He is trying to create something, and she's being a bit oppressive and a bit hovering. And then as things go bad and he can't see her pain, sympathy switches to her. And then as things get worse and worse, it becomes more and more a feeling of her maybe demanding too much out of him, specifically wanting him to shut the world out and have only her. And then as she gets pregnant, it shifts back to her. And it's a back and forth kind of thing. I find the Buñuel film a lot more even keeled in that regard. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think there's ever any question about whose side you're meant to be on in that film. And I don't think it's as complicated. I think you're meant to sympathize maybe a little with some of the people who are suffering more egregiously as a result of what's going on. But I don't think that he does nearly as complicated a thing with kind of switching back and forth with whether you want the people to be in this situation or not.
I think the big contrast to me is Buñuel is so matter of fact. You know, obviously he had a much more limited palette of effects available to him, but I also think he was more interested in finding surrealism and just sort of everyday things. Like the creeping hand is never mistakable for anything except for a glove that's being pulled along, and that's fine. I think that makes it even more uncanny. You know me, I like my clunky analog effects. And with Aronofsky, it's so much more of a manipulation of the environment. I think he says there's more effects in this movie than in Noah, even though they're perhaps a little more disguised. The ability to bend reality by actually bending reality is much more Aronofsky saying, whereas I think it's more with Buñuel. This detail is out of place. This is not quite right. We've seen this thing twice. There's a bear in here. But
where is this bear coming from?
Yeah, it's much more, you're getting a lot more effect out of just by much smaller gestures.
Some of those small gestures are just in the disintegration, as we've said, of the environment. Like they're both, you know, cloistered stories taking place in a single setting. And in both cases, the houses are disintegrating. And in both cases, the houses are disintegrating because of what the people within them are doing. But I think it's an interesting tonal difference that you almost sympathize with the people taking the house apart in an exterminating angel, because it's like, in some ways literal, in some ways figurative, they're clawing at the walls from the inside trying to get out. Whereas in Mother, you know, the fact that people are clawing at the walls, they're clawing at the walls so they can have pieces of it, so they can take it away with them. And it becomes much more like ants dissecting the corpse of an animal. In a horrible sort of way. Whereas with Buñuel, it's more like animals shaking the bars of their cages.
You can't really hold it against them if they're going to axe through a wall to try to get to water, mm-hmm. which is essential. And you can't really hold it against them that they're breaking up the floorboards and the furniture to start a fire so they can eat. I mean, a lot of that makes sense, but in Mother, it's like a lot of wanton destruction and carelessness and not listening to anything that poor Jennifer Lawrence says.
Although I do wonder, like, how actually literal the inspiration was for Aronofsky of that idea of like the wall breaking open and spraying water out of the pipes. I mean, that's just like a really specific visual image that comes up in both films.
Yeah, that's true. I really thought it was more broad, the connection, rather than that, so specific as like a specific incident. But hey,
all things to all people.
Indeed.
Man.
Another point of comparison or perhaps contrast has to do with the depiction of nightmares on film, because as the situation intensifies and both films, the imagery itself becomes a little bit more abstract. But again, the approach is a little bit different. One thing I would point about Mother, now that I think about it, is that fluid camera style where you're just kind of like swishing from one wild image to another in that last third reminded me a little bit of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, about like whisking through someone's conscious and seeing certain doors close and other ones open, and you're just getting a glimpse of things. The camera's just, everything is moving so fast, and there's like a breathless quality to both of the films that, you know, that is not at all Buñuel's style, but it is Aronofsky's style.
Yeah, but what they both have in common, sort of stylistically and conceptually, is this. I think they both really capture the idea of dread that comes with nightmares. The idea that certain things are assumed to be true in dreams, and that's the hardest part to explain to someone when you're trying to tell them about a dream. Is, you know, and my mother was there, but she was also a hyena, and she was also on fire. It's just you when you're in a dream, that is a natural thing. In both of these cases, I think the films do a really interesting job of capturing that dreamlike feeling of something is terribly wrong, but at the same time, it's normal. And I think one thing that's just really interesting for me in comparing them is that for me with Mother, I finally cottoned on to the idea that it was all kind of a surreal dreamscape, that nothing happening in the movie was necessarily literally real. About the time the blood dripped on the floorboard started turning into this expanding, rotting thing. At that point, I was like, oh, okay, it's all a dream. And then everything that fell out after that seemed natural to me because it was part of a dream. Mm-hmm. And it didn't bother me emotionally as much as it might have otherwise. And it didn't bother me as much as it bothered all those cinema score people when weird stuff started happening, because I'd already accepted the dream logic.
Yeah.
For me, with the Buñuel, when we get the hand sliding across the floor, that always takes me out of the movie, because everything is, as Keith has said several times, so straightforward and matter-of-fact and frank. And I'm much more like that variety of absurdism with Exterminating Angel than I like the disembodied hand sliding across the floor and getting stabbed, which to me is just
awesome.
Random.
So great.
Why? Why is it great? Why do you like it?
Because it's a disembodied hand and she's trying to stab it. It's like, how exciting is that? And also, I think the difference too is, like, you can talk about Mother as being nightmarish, whereas Buñuel seems to be interested in how actual nightmares work and how actual hallucinations might work.
But I think even the more mundane sections of Exterminating Angel have that kind of a nightmarish quality to them, too, where it's like, oh, this guy is trying to sexually assault this woman. Well, we just reprimand him and move on because this is how we live now. And, like, once one of the characters mentioned how bad another character smelled, I started to think about how that room must smell and what it would be like, you know, sort of human fluids and rotting sheep. And it is that's a kind of a different kind of nightmare. You can't necessarily experience in sound and vision, but you can imply it pretty strongly.
I'm going to guess that Aronofsky would not imply that. I think you'd probably get a much more visceral sense of that.
Sure.
You wouldn't have to think about it. That's not the type of director that Aronofsky is.
I just think that Mother evokes nightmare really strongly, with that perpetual sense of, A, something is going terribly wrong in the other room. I don't know what it is, but I know it's wrong. And B, the way things appear and disappear. It starts fairly early with Pfeiffer's character suddenly being in a place where she wasn't. And there's an ongoing problem of, that's not where it was when I last saw it. But by the end, I mean, it's a literal walking through a dreamscape where things are perpetually shifting and changing. And that to me evokes nightmare, I think, more clearly than the dread or just the sense of inescapability that happens in the Buñuel movie.
Should we do repetition?
Let's do it twice.
Should we do repetition? I ask you this twice. You know, see how it works.
Thank you, Johnny Two Times.
Johnny Two Times, get the papers. So both of these films repeat things more than once. Again, they repeat things. And but they have different approaches. I mean, we've seen this from Aronofsky before. If you look at a film like Requiem for a Dream, it is all about returning to this same pattern of behavior, and he's showing us how they prepare the drugs and shoot up the drugs, and this is all done in a pattern, basically. And so that's something that sticks with Aronofsky, is certain patterns of behavior, but that's not really the repetition that we see in Exterminating Angel, which is just strange, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is just where we're getting two different scenes done twice with two different outcomes, and there's no explanation for that whatsoever. So it doesn't, not really an insight into human behavior, but some other surreal agenda.
Yeah, and I still don't really know what to make of that in the Buñuel film, because there's just this sense of certain things, like, oh, okay, so the toast is given twice, and the first time people respond to it, and the second time people don't, and the man giving the toast is very nonplussed that the second time nobody responds to it. He very clearly looks around as though everybody's being terribly rude. They're not listening to me. They're not raising their glasses. They're not preparing to clink their glasses. They're instead having conversations among themselves. So, I mean, there's a sense of the breakdown of order, which can feed back into the nightmarishness. There's that sense of surreality. But it doesn't seem nearly as purposeful to me. With the repetition in Mother, that actually bothered me. Probably my least favorite thing about the film was a sense that, for me, after a certain point, I was like, it's a metaphor for fame, it's a metaphor for celebrity, it's a metaphor for the press, it's a metaphor for what you give up when you become famous. You don't need to keep hitting the same point over and over. Because when I wasn't seeing it as an unfolding story about the Bible, when I was seeing it as an unfolding story about her and their relationship, it hits the same point over and over. It escalates. It gets bigger and bigger and louder and louder. But that dynamic of people come into the house, she says, go away. They don't go away. They break things. They insult her. She finally gets rid of them. They come back into the house. Like, that mechanic is repeated over and over. And if a mother has a flaw for me, it's that. The fact that the cycle, to me, at a certain point, kind of becomes, okay, here they come again, back into the house, here he comes again with his excuses.
But you almost think of it like a tornado or something, or like something where you got a lot of different circles going around, and then the big circle is the one that's the circle of creation and death that, mm-hmm. that the film is kind of focused on. So you got a lot of repetitions that kind of swirl around into a much larger one. So to advance kind of a weird visual metaphor for you.
I don't try much more to contribute other than to ask about the one bit of repetition in Mother that I can't really fit neatly in any sort of metaphor, which is, why does she keep drinking that orange liquid? I don't know if we're going to figure that out.
That was a Requiem for a Dream thing, if I ever
Yeah. And I don't know if we're going to figure it out here. And it's, I think apparently it's the one thing that Aronofsky is not, when interviews where he's over-discussing, I think to my taste, over-discussing his own film, that's one thing he won't really explain. So your theories, and certainly kind of like, I'm going to throw that out to listeners as well, any theories they might have on what's going on with that.
You know, I have no idea how it would fit into the biblical metaphor or the climate change metaphor, but for me, on a more literal sense, or the fame metaphor, like, she's a very anxious person. She is, in her own way, very persnickety and very disturbed, and it seems to me like it has a very, like, gothic, taking a laudanum for my nerves kind of feel to it. And there's a point in the movie where she decides not to anymore. And at the point where she does, she more fully enters the nightmare. It feels kind of like a gothic nightmare story about somebody who has walled themselves away from the world and isn't fully engaging with it. And then when she chooses to, it becomes a repulsion-esque nightmare. But I suspect that it would be interesting to go back and watch the movie and look for the specific moments where she drinks the stuff or doesn't drink the stuff and kind of see how that affects the world. And like on a metaphorical sense, I have no idea.
Well, accept the mystery.
Yeah, no. Translate the mystery. Explain the mystery to us listeners.
So The Exterminating Angel is available on Criterion DVD and Blu-ray. It is currently streaming on Filmstruck. It's also available for digital rental on Amazon and iTunes. Mother may or may not be in theaters now, given its box office performance, but it will be talked about for a long time. We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show, in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Keith, what in the film world has been good for you lately?
It's not something that's been good for me lately, but I was thinking of the various pieces of art that Exterminating Angel inspired, or at least it seems to me inspired, and one is the J.G. Ballard novel High Rise. Which is about people living, in a high rise that becomes sort of a microcosm for society, and they leave, but really the focus of their existence is on this. It's a really great book that was turned into not that great movie a couple years ago, last year, right?
Yeah, Ben Wheatley.
Visually striking, but kind of doesn't quite work for some reason. But a movie that really does work is David Cronenberg's 1975 film Shivers, which is also very much inspired by High Rise, and I would guess Exterminating Angel as well. It's his first, if I'm not mistaken, film to receive any kind of commercial release. He'd done a couple of experimental features before then that are both pretty interesting. But this was, it impacting all his Cronenbergian obsessions into a horror film. I mean, making a film that could play in as a horror movie, but also worked as a metaphor for the dark side of the sexual revolution and sort of sexual fear. And it's about these creatures that are both stir sexual desire and then pass along like a venereal disease. And it's about this very state-of-the-art tower apartment complex where it becomes overrun with this parasite and everyone goes out of control and sort of like sex zombies, I guess is probably the way to put it. And I think it is a remarkably assured piece of filmmaking from a very young filmmaker that's raw in ways that he would later refine as he became a more stylish filmmaker. But it's so much, from his very anxious, somewhat unusual heart that's unmistakably anyone else, unmistakable as anyone else's film. And I think it's terrific. I highly recommend it.
Those early Cronenbergs, they aren't as refined as the later films, but they're also grittier and, mm-hmm. And more visceral and tactile, I guess, than some of his later work, which is a little chillier.
Yeah, and like Buñuel, he's not afraid to just run with a metaphor as far as he can take it.
Yeah. Or Aronofsky, for that matter.
Yes, or Aronofsky, for that matter.
You know, I'm still stuck on High Rise, which I agree with you, it doesn't 100% work as a movie, but I think it's got a really some really strong visuals and a really strong central performance from Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah.
But I'm also just struck at how good a pairing that also is with The Exterminating Angel, since it is about a high-rise building where suddenly, for inexplicable reasons, nobody can really leave, and the breakdown of order there. And now I'm really sorry that when I saw that movie, I didn't make the connection necessarily.
Yeah, I didn't make it till watching this and thinking about it. But yeah, and Hiddleston is definitely the go-to person for that, like, sort of slightly removed from humanity protagonist. I mean, it's great casting, and like you said, some great visuals. I just, something about the film, it just annoyed me, I guess is the way to put it. So I would say watch Exterminating Angel, read High Rise, and then watch Shivers. That's my recommendation.
Nice.
Very complicated.
Scott, how about you?
I wanted to recommend a film called Stronger by David Gordon Green. You know, David Gordon Green, we always talk about as being a director whose work has been all over the map. He started so audaciously with George Washington and All the Real Girls, but then has done a lot of studio films and things like The Sitter. And, you know, you never know what you're going to get from him. And I approached this film Stronger with a little bit of trepidation because it does, in its outline, sound like a pretty blah inspirational story. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal as Jeff Bauman, who is a man who lost both of his legs when the bombs exploded at the Boston Marathon. He was there waiting for his on-again-off-again girlfriend, played by Tatiana Maslany, to reach the finish line. And it's about him kind of coming back and trying to find his way there. And what I was surprised is just how brilliantly directed this film is and performed. But one of the things that David Gordon Green does visually is he shoots the film heavily in shallow focus, which makes it so much more intimate and puts this very marked distance between the experience that he is having and what he has come to represent for the city of Boston, the whole Boston Strong thing, which makes him deeply uncomfortable and which is too intense for him. The film is basically a coming home story. It's like a war movie. That's the approach that's being taken with it. And it's about, you know, all the struggles and coming back, about the physical struggles, the psychological struggles, the relationship problems, the money problems. It really just gets down to that very intimate level, while also acknowledging that, you know, he had an additional problem of having to represent a city that needed a hero out of this tragic story. So I thought it's a much more complex film than I expected. It is a much better and more impressive piece of direction from David Gordon Green than I expected. So I recommend it Stronger. And Jake Gyllenhaal is terrific, as is Maslany, who I had not seen in her big show, which is called
Orphan Black.
Orphan Black. I've not seen Orphan Black, but
great.
I hear she's fantastic. Great. And she is really outstanding here. I mean, this movie has my favorite shot, single shot of any movie this year. I don't want to give it away, but it's another example of that shallow focus strategy paying off big time. So
Stronger. That is a strong recommendation. I had the chance to see it at TIFF and I passed up on it because, in spite of the talent involved, it seemed like the potential for corniness and uplift overcoming disability movie was just so strong.
One other note I'll say, this is so much more authentic and real seeming a portrait of working class Boston, you know, yellers, I guess, than The Fighter. To me, this is so much more on point, and that actually is another David Gordon Green hallmark, is incorporating a lot of improvisation and looseness, I guess, to the talk, and you get really excellent supporting performances by unexpected people like Miranda Richardson and Clancy Brown, and it's not bad. I think it's a good movie.
When's it coming out?
Stronger came out on the 22nd and should be making its way to your city if it hasn't already.
It's not going to inspire a bunch of thickly accented tweets from our old coworker Matt Singer.
It will. It will. I didn't think about that. I welcome those. Tasha, how about you?
Well, I saw a lot of movies at TIFF, and they broke down relatively neatly into things I enjoyed and that don't have distribution yet and are looking for it, and things that I somewhere between didn't like and liked okay but didn't love, things that are coming up soon. So there wasn't a whole lot of crossover there, except for the one title that I'm going to recommend called The Big Bad Fox and Friends, which is a cute little animated movie that is like certainly nothing else I saw at TIFF amid the barrage of prestige movies and horror movies I saw this year. It's from Benjamin Renner, is one of the directors of Ernest and Celestine, which is a film I rhapsodized about back at the Dissolve. A really interesting animated film about the friendship between a mouse and a bear, which is made distinctive by the fact that one of them lives in a mouse world that is dedicated to destroying bears, and one of them lives in a giant-sized bear world that has its own weird, sophisticated civilization. Renner is an artist and a writer who has his own book, and he turned this book into a French film. It's a series of vignettes about these barnyard animals who don't really have names. They're just rabbit and fox and chicken and pig. And the whole movie is presented as a series of skits, plays that they're putting on in a little theater. So there are little sort of entr'actes where one of the characters comes forward of the curtains and kind of talks about what you just saw, and the characters interact as though they're actors. And then the curtains sweep open and we get these strange, like whimsical, crazy, antic, slapdash fable stories about life on the farm. Ernest and Celestine is an incredibly visually rich movie. The backdrops here have a lot of the same look, but the characters are these very simple, cartoonish sort of characters, not unlike the newspaper comic strip Pearls Before Swine. But the energy of this movie is so like rambunctious and playful and absurdist and ridiculous. It was like a real drink of fresh, cold water at TIFF in the middle of all of the other things I saw. Very few things at TIFF made me laugh out loud the way this movie did. It's entirely kid-friendly. It's something that you could watch with small children. But it's also pretty adult-friendly because it's really ridiculous, fun humor. G-Kids has picked it up, the New York organization that seems to grab every interesting
cool
bit of European animation. And their usual modus operandi is it'll probably open in New York and L.A. sometime in November, December for a qualifying run at the Oscars. I wouldn't be surprised if it turned up at the Oscars because a lot of G-Kids stuff does. And then sometime after that, it'll be available on DVD and streaming. The version I saw was in French with subtitles, but they also typically do really, really good dubs. So look for it at the point where it comes out, The Big Bad Fox and Other Tales.
Okay. Well, I'll have to write that one down. I missed it at TIFF along with so many other films.
It's the way they work.
Yeah, it really is. So many movies. So that's it for this week's edition of The Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out October 17th and 19th. Tasha, what do we have on tap?
Okay, so Ridley Scott has been a pretty busy fellow lately with cranking out sequels to his 1979 horror movie Alien, which we discussed on a previous Next Picture Show. But that may explain why he hasn't had time to take on the latest iteration of Blade Runner, his 1982 film about a man whose job is hunting down rogue androids. Or maybe the character isn't a man after all. I mean, that's one of the big questions of the original Blade Runner. Who knows? Whether Rick Deckard, played by Harrison Ford, is human or he is yet another android. This debate has raged for decades, even as hotly debated variant cuts of the film have suggested different answers, and Ridley Scott himself has kind of definitively weighed in on the question. So it'll be interesting to see how the long percolating sequel Blade Runner 2049 takes up the question. Harrison Ford is back as Rick Deckard, but the new film stars Ryan Gosling is a new android hunter looking into a conspiracy. Ridley Scott has stepped down as director, replaced by Denis Villeneuve, director of Arrival, Sicario, and Enemy. So we're planning on looking at both the old and new Blade Runners to see how well they channel the queasy, paranoid futures of Philip K. Dick. We're going to find out who wore Blade Running better, and we're going to find out whether Harrison Ford is planning to continue his streak of killing off his most career-making characters one by one.
Well, I'm excited. Just to find out. I also want to really that question about whether he is or isn't an android. That intrigues me, Keith.
You hadn't thought about that before.
I've thought about it. I'm being sarcastic. In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of The Exterminating Angel, Mother, and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Keith Phipps.
You can find me at uprocks.com, where I'm the editorial director of film and television, and occasionally I get to do some writing. I wrote a long thing on E.T. recently. Mm. And you can find me on Twitter at kphipps3000.
Tasha?
You can find me these days recording with Pop Culture Happy Hour. I just taped the fourth show with them, this one discussing the aftermath of TIFF and what's coming up in the fall prestige season. Always a lot of fun talking with those guys. You can find me on Twitter at Tosh Robinson. You can find me writing about film and running the film and TV section over at TheVerge.com. Scott, where can we find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias. You can find a wealth of Variety reviews from TIFF 12 in all on Variety. A lot of flotsam and jetsam, but a few things that I actually liked. And as usual, you can find me at the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, and I'm the editor-in-chief of Oscilloscope's Musings blog, and we've got some pretty good stuff going up on the site, so check that out. You can also follow our absent co-host, Genevieve, on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky, and find her work at the Vox.com culture section. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at Next Picture Pod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. And while you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks to Colin the Animal Griffith for his assistance producing the show. And thanks to Delmark Records for providing recording space at their home base, Riverside Studios. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time.